After what seems like no time at all, Ernesto finds himself at his first day at the San Juan Bautista Monastery, an old mission south of San Diego. A beat-up, desert-preserved checkered cab from the late 50s drops him off and immediately takes off, leaving a cloud of dust to hang in the evening light. Ernesto knocks on the monastery's oxidized brass door. Immediately, the door is answered by an older brother, with a decidedly European look about him. Ernesto is floored.
Brother Pierre?
Yes, Monty. It's good to see you again.
Sister Olympia didn't tell me you lived here now.
Yes. We monks, Monty, lead very interesting lives. Well, I'm beginning to learn that, yeah. I see you've packed quite light, Brother Pierre comments, noting Ernesto's backpack and small duffel bag. Yeah, well, no need for clothes anymore. Just boxers and undershirts, mostly. Oh, and socks and books, and an alarm clock and journal. You know, Monty, we wear clothes under our habits.
Oh, okay, that's good. Yeah, I was concerned about how the winters might go. If it's possible, could I call my nephew?
Yes, of course. But first, let me show you your new home. Ernesto follows Pierre down the adobe front hall, which opens to reveal a massive rectangular courtyard dominating the center of the monastery. The courtyard is divided into quadrants by two slate walkways, with the limestone statue of San Juan Bautista standing at the intersection. Ernesto notes each section is distinctly different from the other. First is the monastery's garden, packed with rich, ruddy brown soil. Orderly rows of vegetables stretch the section's length, and homemade trellises support all manner of vine fruits and berries. This section, Brother Pierre explains, is meant to allow the brothers to meditate on the virtue of work. The next section is filled with scores of California wildflowers, like something you'd see in a roadside postcard. All sorts of varieties, though as a rule all extremely tall, sparse things, straight-stemmed and scraggly-leafed for 5 feet or so, until their tops explode with color, like little organic fireworks. They walk through the section at its tamest point, a circular, slate path that cuts through each quadrant, keeping the statue of San Juan at its center. As Ernesto admires a flower shaped like a red votive candle, his guide explains the section is meant to make its guest meditate on the beauty God creates free from human assistance. They continue on the circle path to plot 3. This is the one Ernesto had been eyeing the entire time, for planted in section 3 is a giant western white pine, at least 90 feet tall. The tree is bare for the first third or so, before it sprouts branches about 30 feet in diameter. The trunk is bigger than a monster truck wheel. The surrounding monastery, with its simple one-floor design, is dwarfed by its presence. This tree, Brother Pierre explains, is meant to inspire awe and allow us to meditate on that feeling. Ernesto, still staring up at the tree's upper reaches, replies,
"Yeah, it is awesome,
especially in a setting like this. But is it really worth it, brother? I mean, aren't you afraid it could fall one day and destroy the monastery? Aren't you afraid it could kill someone?" Brother Pierre smiles softly. "Fear, Monty, is necessary to achieve all." They round the circle to plot 4, a fallow, dirt-packed patch of earth like some sort of ghost town thoroughfare. The slate slabs of the circle path are the only things breaking up the expanse of earth. This dormant, dusty lot allows us to meditate on our origins as well as our conclusions.
I like the tree one best.
You will come to like them all. Come, let us go for supper. The other brothers are waiting.
What about my bags?
It's okay. Come. They step back to the open-air hallway and walk around to a door across from the garden. Inside is the monastery dining room, scantily furnished with a long wooden table and bench seating. The 20 or so residents of the monastery sit quietly in prayer, a collection of bowed heads and saggy necks. Port windows at the rear of the room throw beams of evening light across the scene. "Brothers, if you'll excuse the interruption, this is Monty. He has come to learn about life at San Juan and possibly join the order. Please make him feel welcome." The room is still silent, but an unspoken goodwill fills the air that is palpable. "Now, let us begin our meal with a prayer." The congregation bows its head. Ernesto wipes his hands on his jeans as if preparing to shake someone's hand after using the bathroom. His left hand brushes against a bulge in his pocket he didn't know was there. As Brother Pierre leads the group in prayer, eyes closed, Ernesto stealthily removes the folded-up piece of notebook paper from his pocket. It only takes a second of scanning for a spark of enthusiasm to light Ernesto's face, at which point he furtively folds the note back up and assumes a prayerful pose. Brother Pierre closes the prayer, but before he can sit for dinner, Ernesto taps him on the shoulder. "Brother, may I say a few words before dinner?" "Go ahead, Monty." "Hi, everyone. I wrote this on the bus here. I had forgotten about it until now. Things have been kind of rough lately. I won't go into details, but one of my problems is I can't seem to dream anymore. I used to have these really lucid, vivid dreams, but now I can't anymore, and my life didn't make sense for a while. With the Brotherhood, I see hope, but things are still a struggle. I still want to write poetry too, if only for myself, so I have to find new sources of inspiration. Instead of dreaming, I wrote this on the bus after 72 hours without sleep. It's called A Conversation with Jesus. I'd like to read it for you all, if that's okay." Again, nothing is said, but Ernesto can tell he's been granted consent. A Conversation with Jesus. "When I go to hell, Jesus, who will get my LPs? Who will cry when they play Pet Sounds at my funeral, as per my request? Jesus, please say hello to Otis Redding for me, and I'll be sure to give your regards to everyone else. When I go to hell, Jesus, will it matter that I'm registered with the Green Party? Will there be politicians there, or is that just cliche? If I were you, Jesus, I wouldn't put them there. Somebody has to embody the worst of humanity. Who do you think you are, Jesus, to let them turn news into infotainment? I'm getting tired of you hiding behind this idea of free will. What kind of God are you to let Saturday Night Live get to this point? I'm concerned, Jesus. I don't think Surrey is a Christian name. Do they have Us Weekly down there, or is that one of those great ironies of hell they're always talking about? Can't you just kill those people that insist the Da Vinci Code is real already? I'm tainted, Jesus. Bad dates. I'm nervous, man. This is it. I've got no more outs. I can't do it out there anymore. I can't sit with the idiots and I can't snicker with the elitists. Help me find comfort. Help me or damn me." Some silences are consenting, but some are just awkward. Ernesto folds up the loose leaf and looks down at the floor. "Thank you, Monty. How about we eat dinner?" "Okay." Before he knows it, a month at the monastery has passed Ernesto by. To remember anything that happened in that time seems impossible to him. All that comes to mind when looking back is an overbearing sense of failure. Every attempt at communication ended in culture conflict, which in turn would only push him to try harder and resulted in increasingly spectacular failures. Last night, Ernesto recalls as the capper, when Brother Paul, not that Brother Paul, but also a saint of a man, God bless him, Ernesto's eighth grade science teacher, had a minor heart event while sharing cooking duties with Ernesto. He couldn't help but think he was the cause,
Why else would Brother Pierre take him out of Friday morning rosary to have a talk? Monty, the brothers and I, we can see that you are struggling to find your inner peace.
Yes. Oh, yes, Brother Pierre, absolutely. I don't mean to upset the other brothers. I really don't. It's just that I can't help wanting to find common ground with them. I want to, but it seems like I'm too corrupted. It's like the poem. I'm too much of a product of our corrupt culture.
Monty, with God, nothing is too corrupted. The brothers and I decided you might benefit from some time spent exclusively meditating. But what about prayer time and chores? Meditation is prayer. And do not worry about your chores. The Brotherhood is a family, and a family supports its members. Thank you, Brother Pierre. I won't let you or the brothers down.
I know, Monty. The pair step out from the open-air hallway and onto the courtyard, where they walk the slate circle path together. Here, walk the circle path for a while. See where it leads you. They walk together in silence for a few revolutions before Brother Pierre excuses himself. Alone, left with all the time in the world to sort out his problems, Ernesto has no idea where to begin. Vegetables, flowers, tree, dust. Work, beauty, awe, origins. He turns around and starts walking the path counterclockwise. Nothing. He picks up the pace and starts jogging around the path, doing 20-second laps. Nothing. He slows down and focuses all his attention on the statue of San Juan, hoping for some divine inspiration. Nothing. Ernesto lies down on the packed earth and stares up at the early morning sky. He's frustrated, but mostly scared. It doesn't seem so long ago that he had been certain this was the path for him. He hadn't been sure of any decision in years. Now everything seems to be falling apart. If this isn't the answer, what is? What will make him happy again? God, what do I do?
Madison. The girl from your poem was Madison Quigley, and every time you smell indelible marker, you think of her. She wore flowers in her hair that first day of seventh grade, even though she was 12 and it was 1980. She and you had always been in the same grade, but now, sharing a bus, you finally got to know her. Not right away, though. It took you until just before Halloween to gather up the courage to talk to her. You traded her your Reese's peanut butter cup from the class Halloween party goodie bag for 6 M&Ms, even though you both knew that was an unfair trade. After that, you started talking on the bus, mostly gossip about who was dating whom and what girls in the class Madison thought were sluts. You just admired the skin of her cheek and how her eyes drifted to the ceiling whenever she tried to remember something, mouth just slightly open. One lonely Friday in November, when you were both waiting for the late bus, Madison showed you the leaf geysers. She talked about her father dying, and how her mom and sister had to move across town to a new home. And how after the funeral, she had come back to the church across from school and saw the geysers and thought it was a sign from her dad. And how when she saw it again a week later from across the street at the diner, she stopped believing in signs. You didn't know what to say, so you jumped up from the bench and burst through a geyser like a sprinter crossing the tape. She ran after, giggling and holding her arms out at her sides to let the wind push her along. You started up a leaf fight, and right in the middle she kissed you and then ran off to hide in the school. Somehow she got home without taking the late bus. That Monday, your relationship went back to the way it was before Halloween. Madison started dating other boys from the grade, and secretly you longed for her. One time during recess, Joey Kennedy bragged about touching her boob, and you made it a point to never talk to him again. After Easter break, Madison started talking to you again, but this time it was different.
She'd talk of nothing but kissing and boys, and most times you'd have to sit with your backpack on your lap. Sometimes when you said something funny, or sometimes when you said anything at all, she would laugh and touch her hand to your forearm. On the last day of seventh grade, she gave you her number and told you to call her. You called her every week to make plans with her. Each time, she'd agree to meet or call you, and each time she never did. She would apologize with such sincerity that you always forgave her. Even that last time in August, when you swore to yourself you wouldn't forgive her again, she started crying on the phone about how much she missed her father, and you spent the next 3 hours talking her down. When Madison got on the bus with flowers in her hair that first day of eighth grade, you gave her the special rock you got from your trip to Crater Lake that you had been waiting to give her since June. It was white with red speckles and shaped like a dime store snow globe. The bottom was as smooth as polished granite, and when you held it at an angle to the sky, pure light reflected back. She said thank you and put it in her backpack without looking at it. It took you a few months to get over her indifference, but eventually you did. You started talking to Benedict Delacroix, who sat next to you in math class. One day you suggested she should come over to your house to work on homework, and she agreed. You were the last two to get on the bus that day, running across the parking lot in a strong rain. You smiled at Madison as you climbed the bus steps, and she quickly looked away. As you passed her seat, you sensed movement and turned to see her lunging at your waist. She grabbed hold of your belt loops and pulled, bringing your uniform pants to your knees. She smiled now, like how she smiled when she used to touch your arm with your backpack on your lap. You wanted to hit her. You wanted her to get the uneven end of the trade for once. But all you did was pull up your pants while the younger kids laughed at you. She invited Benedict to sit with her, and Benedict accepted, looking you up and down from her seat with the face that asked you why you were still standing there. As they laughed and gossiped together, you sat two rows behind them, looking out at the rain and plotting their deaths. When it was time to get off the bus, and Benedict asked if you wouldn't mind if she went home with Madison, you didn't bother responding. You got to your house and opened your math book, where you started with algebra, but ended with profanities and ill-formed hate etched into your paper with forceful pen presses. Your math notebook turned into your first journal that day, and your first poem followed a month later. Ernesto lies there a few moments, staring up at the sky. He has no idea where that just came from. The words had simply flowed from his mouth, each new sentence appearing like another boxcar on an impossibly long freight train. As he lifts himself, still seated, his eyes fall on the statue of San Juan. The statue looks skyward, arms out to the side in a pose of complete surrender. Ernesto jumps up and tears across the courtyard, holding up the length of his habit like a sundress. Without reservation, he bursts into the monastery's modest chapel, where the brothers are praying the glorious mysteries. "Brother Pierre, I've found it!" Brother Pierre looks up from the front row, as if roused from sleep. "What?" "My inner peace! I've found my inner peace!" "Really? Already?" "Yes! Isn't that fantastic?" Brothers shift on kneelers and sigh deeply. He can sense the irritation, but Ernesto's too high above it. "But you've only been out in the courtyard half an hour." "Brother, I've been out in the courtyard my whole life. The answer was there all along. I was just too prideful to accept it. I asked God, brother. I asked God for help, and he responded. He spoke through me about the girl that pants me in eighth grade, and suddenly it all came together. My poetry hadn't been about celebrating anything.
It'd have been about proving some girl wrong. And how long can you really expect to draw inspiration from something like that?
Brother Pierre looks at Ernesto curiously. Monty, did you not believe in God before?
I mean, yeah, kinda. I mean, I more believed in his principles than him. But that's over now. I was wrong. I couldn't find my peace until now, but once I opened up to God, he came and showed me the root of all my distress. The words came out of me without any thought. It was just so clear and mapped out. It was miraculous. And now I understand why you're all so peaceful. It's not solitude or celibacy or some sense of sacrifice. It's surrender. Surrender to an all-powerful being that loves you and will take care of you. And brothers, I know I sound crazy and I wouldn't even believe me. Why should God come through me and not one of you? So much holier, such better servants. But it's true. I see this whole urge to join the Brotherhood wasn't even my idea. It was God speaking to me, and I was too self-absorbed to see it. But I laid down, outside, in the dust, in our origins. And God came through me and showed me my origins. And I don't know how else I could convince you, but that's what it is.
The mood has changed. What was once impatience has turned to compassion. Brother Pierre smiles at Ernesto, like you would a child who's just discovered some small wonder out in the garden.
Well, let's stay out there a couple more days, just to be sure.
Yes, brother, whatever you say.
Ernesto doesn't move. He just stands there, face beaming.
Okay, you can go back now.
May I say one more thing?
Yes.
I also realized something on the run over here, something I've been lying about all this time. My name isn't Ernesto. It's Monty. Montgomery Jackson. I'm done being dishonest with myself. I think I always hated the name as a kid. It sounds like some old Southern general in a white suit. I changed it as soon as I could get away with lying about it. But no more being dishonest with myself.
The mood of the room shifts yet again, this time from benevolence to confusion. Brother Pierre speaks up.
Okay, thank you, Monty. And if anyone goes to see Brother Paul tonight, the heart thing, I feel real bad about that. Please, tell him I said hello, and I'm sorry.